My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. My group is the Markham Village Group in Ontario, Canada. I have a sponsor. I sponsor a lot of women, and I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so delighted to be here. I was here 6 years ago, so thank you so much for asking me back. I was never asked back anywhere. I'm so grateful. And it's been such a wonderful conference. I mean, really. Alan says that, you know, that you can't screw up these things. Well, we can. We can screw up anything. But God is there to fix it, always. And I want to thank the committee. For all the effort they put into this. It's like Jared said last night, it took 6 years of preparation. That's a lot of dedication. You know, that's a lot of dedication, and I think they deserve a big round of applause for that. Thank you so much. And I've enjoyed the speakers very much. It's been a wonderful weekend. And My good friend Bob, we share the same sponsor, and we're a lot together, and I never get tired of hearing him. And Erica and Diane picked me up at the airport. You know, I love coming into airports because, you know, it's almost like airports confuse alcoholics. They just become different people. And I always look for the ones that have the alcoholic eyes of, is this real? And of course, it was hard to miss her because she had a sign saying Mary G, so I knew it was her. Thank you so much. Thank you both very much. When it's defining what a spiritual awakening is in the back of the big book, it talks about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And when I was on the plane coming down here, I realized I'd had a personality change. You know, for someone who was such an immoral, I was a reprobate, you know, and I was a feral drunk, you know. Once upon a time, I came from civilized people, but now I'm living in the wild, you know. And when I'm sitting on the plane, to show you how much I've changed, we took off, and there's a man sitting next to me, and across the aisle is another fellow, and he's got in his earplugs. And the steward comes and says, "Sir, take out your earplugs. You're not allowed to use them until the pilot tells you." And he took out the earplugs, and then you put them back in again. So I took note of this because I am now wanting the entire world to behave well. So, so the steward comes out again and said, "Please take out your earplugs." So he takes out one. And I said to the fellow next to me, "What's wrong with him? Doesn't he know how to take direction?" So I decide I'm going to give this guy spiritual rays, and I keep looking at him, but he won't catch my eye, you know. So then I start to lecture this one sitting next to me about the necessity for the world to be able to take instruction and live within a structured universe for the benefit of all. And he said to me, "Well, I'm with him." So I just separated myself from them. So you can probably hear I'm not from Canada. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. I've got Irish, English, and Scottish heritage. It's kind of like Braveheart, the Queen, and St. Patrick. And you know, I love what Joe said. You know, if there is a predisposition to the illness of alcoholism, if there are symptoms of alcoholism long before we drank, then I certainly had alcoholism long before I drank. and how it manifested in me, those feelings of difference, the feelings of being less than, the feelings of being on the outside looking in. I was born with a criminal mindset. I really was, you know. I was never taught to steal. It just came natural. You know. I was never taught to lie. It just came second nature to me. It's not because I didn't come from a good family. I came from a good Roman Catholic family. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. And my father had been a Franciscan monk, you know, who left the monastery, not for any bad reason. So I was taught nothing about except how to be good, and I just had no ability for it. It just didn't come natural. The other thing about me was, from a very early age, much like our co-founder Bill Wilson, if you read Bill's story, I became very anxious. I started developing panic attacks. I started having an obsession with death. You know, I was just, it was very difficult for me from a very young age. And also I was endlessly fascinated by myself. And, you know, my old grandfather was my hero. And he was a weekend drunk. And every Friday and Saturday night he'd come staggering down the road, walking from east to west, the way the drunk walks. And all the neighbors were behind their curtains laughing at my hero. And my granny was behind the curtain with a rolling pin and the rosary, you know. The two staples of the Irish household. And every Friday and Saturday night there would be war in my home. And I said to myself, I will not drink. I will never drink. And on a Sunday morning, when my old grandfather and I, we used to go up to church together, and he'd be sitting before we left with his head in his hands. And I used to say to him, what are you thinking about, Pop Daddy? And he would say to me, I'm pondering the immensities. And I was to ponder the immensities until I almost disappeared into my navel, thinking about things. And the other thing I had from a very early age was almost a seeming inability to accept much on faith, as it says in the big book. I just could not accept the faith of my forefathers. I always had a question about God. God just didn't sit well with me, you know. I don't know what it was, you know, I just think it was I was told later on I had a personality disorder, an abnormal personality, and I'm absolutely fine with that, but I didn't know that back then. I just knew there was something. Look, everything I knew about myself was because other people told me. I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me, because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with me. I always knew I was really odd, because people were saying to me, you're very odd. You know, every year my family would take me to Ireland to see my Irish family. And they would say to my mother, she's not right, you know. And if you're not right in Ireland, you're not right anywhere. You know, Ireland's an open-air asylum, you know, And then they would take me down to England and they would say, she's a bit queer in the attic. So what do you do with all of that? Well, the thing too is, like Bill Wilson, he said that in the end, these feelings of being less than and of not being equal to and of just being so different turned into aggression. And that's what happened to me. I became aggressive. I used to fight. From I was very young, I was getting into a lot of fights because I didn't like people, but I wanted them to love me. And also, if you had something I wanted, I would steal it from you. And if you accused me, then I would just hit you. You know. It didn't make for good relations, and I was taken to the priest, and I didn't like what the priest had to say, and I was educated by nuns, and I didn't like the nuns, You know, and when I was 15 one day, a nun hit me over the hand with a ruler, and I figured if she could give it, she could take it. It's only in AA you laugh at that. Any place else in the world would say, you're disgusting, you hit a nun. Here they say, yeah. I made amends. Every time I see a nun, I make amends. And I got thrown out of that school. And they had the Mother Superior nun. She came and took me out of the classroom and said, we've got in touch with your mother and she'll be coming to pick you up. And I want you to sit outside my room and memorize that sign above my door before she comes. And I looked at the sign and it said, of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness, but in my walks to me it seems that the grace of God is in courtesy. And way back then I wanted nothing to do with the grace of God, and I want nothing to do with courtesy. But many years later, coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, having lived on the street, having lost everything of value in my life, it was the grace of God that brought me to you. And it was the great courtesy you extended to a broken human being who had lost all humanity and all femininity that had me stay here. So it came true. You see, God is always chasing people like us, because grace is only given to the sinner. And I was a sinner. And God was always chasing me. But I just didn't know it. And broke my mother's heart. Got into a lot of trouble. I remember when they took me to Ireland one year. And a lot of the years they took me, they used to take me to the cathedral. There's a beautiful big old cathedral in Drogheda where my family are. And inside that cathedral is the head of a martyred saint. He was martyred 300 years ago. And his head's still there. They've got it in a glass case. He was hung, drawn, and quartered by the English, much like Braveheart was, and burnt. They couldn't think of enough things to do to this guy. And so there's a burnt head inside this glass case on the altar, but he still had teeth. That fascinated me. I mean, because teeth are a rare commodity in my country, you know. And my family used to sit me down and say, if you sit down and study and pray to St. Oliver Plunkett, it will do something for your soul, because he really loved God. And I looked at this burnt head and I thought, if he really loved God and that's what happened to him, I want something different, you know. Then this horrendous obsession with death. They used to give me panic attacks because I knew by now that if I wasn't going to heaven, if there was a heaven and hell, I wasn't going there. And I was only 15, 16, and I'd done so many things I shouldn't have done. So many. I live in Glasgow, Scotland. You know, a lot of bigotry in Glasgow, Scotland. It's kind of like Belfast West. You know, a lot of fighting between the religions. And when I was young, I was a part of all of that. And so I knew I was in trouble. And then I started saying to myself, I don't want to break my mother's heart anymore, and I want to be like other people. Why am I so different? No matter what I do, I can't feel the same as. And when my friends were 15, 16, my peers, because I didn't really have friends, they started dating. And I am there with this obsession with death, and I am there thinking, maybe if I can get out of my mind and date. And I go out with a guy, and the first night he takes me out, after he takes me on a date, he takes me home and wants to get passionate with me. And at the height of his passion, I said to him, so what do you think about death? Yes. He said, I think you should go home now. I wasn't meant for this world in that state. I needed a drink. You see, I did not know that what a drink would do is exactly what eventually the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous would do for me slowly. That a drink would do for me quickly is give me a change of personality. That's what alcohol did for me. I had a personality disorder, and I needed a change of personality. And I didn't know that's what alcohol would do for me. I didn't drink to get high. I was born high. I was born in high alert. I was a very nervous human being. I needed someone to calm me down. Give me a little ease and comfort. And I didn't know that. So I set off in my merry way, and I went into nursing, and I got bored with nursing, and then I went down to London, England, and I joined British Airways. It was then BOAC. We were the creme de la creme of the air hostesses. And I'm flying all over the world. I'm up in a plane with all these people. I don't like people. And I'm claustrophobic. And I have panic attacks. It was not a good career choice, and it did not make the flying public feel secure. And then at age 23, I think if I get married, I'll be well. I see people get married. Maybe if I get married and have a family, then I'll feel like everybody else. Because I was coming to the end of my rope. 23 years old, walking the world, never had a drink, never had a pill. Had a severe psychiatric something, you know. And my family didn't help, because, like, my family are loopy, you know. I mean, I have an aunt, and she can be sitting having a cup of tea, and all of a sudden she freezes in time. You know, you can do that, and she doesn't move. And people will come in and say, what happened to her? And my loopy family say, she's just away, she'll soon be back. So they didn't find anything that strange in my behaviour. And so I get married. I marry a really nice man, cultured, came from a very good family. I married a nice man, and he married a figment of my imagination. And he took me to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And in Kingston, Jamaica, I had everything that money could buy. And at the end of a year, my first son was born. And just after he was born, I thought I was going insane. What should have been? I love that little boy with every fiber of my being, but I held that child and I looked at him, and he was so perfect. And I never thought I could produce something this perfect. And then something came on that later I have been told was psychosis, post-traumatic psychosis. And I thought I was going mad. And I'd never, ever. Finally, I'm 25 years, I'm going into the abyss, and I'm never going to come out again. And I knew it. And they brought a doctor, and he wanted to give me an injection, and a friend of mine said, give her a drink. And she was Danish. Good friend of mine today, even today. Wonderful girl. She said, give her a drink. And Jamaica has 151 proof rum. Oh, yeah. I saw that. How sweet it is, right? And I don't know if it was the first drink, the second drink, or the third drink, but for the first time in my life, my skin fit. That's all. And then there's nothing else to tell you but that. That's all. I got a sense of ease and comfort, hitherto unknown to me. I got to feel all right. For the first time in 25 years, I felt the way other people always look to me. I had been searching for that something the way you look to me, where life was effortless, where you fitted into this world, where everything was all right, where you didn't have to think and pull yourself up before you walked into a room, where you didn't think everybody was looking at you all the time, where you didn't have this unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness, where everybody's looking at me and judging me and know that I'm not all right. I have a few drinks, not all goes away. And that's why I drink. If it didn't do that, I wouldn't drink it. And I immediately drank on a daily basis. And I had found my magic. And for 4 years, I had everything that money could buy. I had my BMW. I'd go to the country club. I'd have a little drinky poo in the morning before setting off. And then I'd play a few rounds of tennis and have a nice rum punch, one or two or three. And then in the afternoon, I'd have my afternoon drinky poos. And then in the evening, I was drinking an enormous amount of alcohol. I had an amazing tolerance. And then after about 4 years, a cucumber becomes a pickle. And there's no going back. And my second son was born. I drank every day I carried that child because I'd lost the power of choice in drink. I didn't even think it would be bad for him. I didn't fall down drunk. I just drank every day. I didn't know then that I was maintaining as best as I could. And my son was born fine. I have two little boys, and now I'm a hopeless alcoholic, and I can't stop. And my behavior changes because I no longer get the required personality change. It's not working anymore. And now I'm becoming just aggressive and obnoxious and horrible. And I don't know if it's the first drink, the second drink, or the third drink. And I had some friends. I don't know if you know about Jamaica. It's out of many one people. We have every nationality living in Jamaica. Every nationality. And they've been there for hundreds of years. And it's a fascinating place to live. And I had some friends who had started to follow Bob Marley, who I didn't approve of. And Bob didn't like me because I was drunk. And I didn't like him because he was a pothead. I didn't realize what a great humanitarian he was. He'd moved across the road. He'd been given a big old great house by his record producers. And he had a BMW and I had a BMW. But I didn't like him and he didn't like me, so I didn't care. And some friends of mine came and said, "Mari, come try a little sense of me, oh, your man. Come try a little ganja. Look how the liquor's making your eyes red." I said, "I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor. Thank you." You know, and I'd watch them and they'd roll a big spliff and it was so big you couldn't even see their face. And they'd say, "I just want to mellow out, man. Have a little vision." And they'd lie down and meditate. That's not me. When I drink, I want justice. When I drink, I want freedom for all. When I drink, I want love. I will eventually end up lying down whether I want to or not. But not right now. So, and then my husband, as all my husbands have, developed an aversion to me through feeling constantly under attack. He developed a nervous condition. We used to go to the country club and I'd act badly. And he'd run me home and lecture me and I'd say to him, "If you drop asleep tonight, I'll kill you." And he would go. And one night he didn't drop asleep. He did drop asleep and I hit him over the head with a piece of mahogany. And he had no sense of humor. And my children were 5 and 9 and I decided to divorce them and leave the island. And he didn't want to let me go, but I was a horrible human being. A horrible human being. And I said to him, "If you don't let me go, I'm going to publish something in the newspaper about you." Because I was all about winning. I was all about winning and all about one up. And I truly love my children, but I certainly was. I should never have been allowed to leave the island. I was already a chronic alcoholic. And I took the children off the island, and a man had said to me, "Let's get married and I'll take you to Canada. I love getting married. I love it. I just don't have any follow through, you know." You know, I used to love, I'm so glad I'm too old now, because that thing used to move me around getting married. I used to just look to get married. And what used to happen to me is I'd fall in love and him and I would be like Velcro. And we'd get married. Hi, I love you. I love you. Let's get married. You know. Instant gratification. And so we get married, and then after about 2 months, I can hear him breathing. Did he always breathe like that? Did he always walk like that? Because I have, it's not him. The common denominator is me. I have no consistency. I have no compassion. I have no concern. The three C's that we learn in here. Caring, consideration, and compassion. I don't have that. So then I sent him away. And that was the story. And yeah, in Alberta, I'm shaking so much I can't get my drink up in the morning. I get a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And get into Valium and liquor. And now it's just me and my two little boys. And I never physically abused them, but I'm an alcoholic mother. I tried to take care of them, but I couldn't. See, I loved them. And that is a great conundrum to me that baffles me even till today. I love my children more than I've ever loved anything, with a constancy in my soul and my heart. And yet I could not stop drinking. I couldn't stop. And some nights I'd tell them I'm going out for milk. And I'd leave those two little boys and I'd go to the bar for one drink. And I'd end up lying on the washroom floor of the ladies' room, and it's late at night, and someone will take me home that I don't even remember. And my sons will wake up through the night and I don't know they've woken up. And the next day they'll say to me, "Mommy, who was that man that was here last night?" And I'd say, "There was no man, you were dreaming." I have my children question their reality. That is a horrible, horrible part of this horrible alcoholism and what it does to our innocent little children. And I'd drive with them drunk in the car and they'd be screaming and afraid. And I remember one time my youngest boy said, "Mom, can you bring some Jamaican food to cook some Jamaican food and bring it to school?" I said, "I will." And I woke up that morning, I said, "I'm not going to drink." And then the madness comes on. And I know that there's nothing I can do without a drink. And I'll just have one. And I start to cook and I just have one drink. And then the madness comes on again. And I know that I can't stop. And I drink and I cook and I get drunk and I take the chicken to school. And my little son shouts, "See, I told you my mommy was coming." And then I drop down drunk in front of him and break the chicken and the plate, and my little boys are there looking at me with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic. And my family came and put me in detox in Calgary, Alberta, and it was just me and five Native Canadians in Calgary detox in 1979. And I had DTs, and they were very kind to me, and they, you know, they used to put a belt in my tongue and when I was having convulsions, and they'd hold my soup to me and my coffee to me when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. And they told me that they drank because their spirit was broken, and I knew at some level my spirit was broken. And it was many years later, reading a Carl Jung, Bill Wilson correspondence, when Carl Jung wrote to Bill Wilson and said it is his opinion that what the alcoholic suffers from, he has a thirst for a union with God, that he drinks spirit, but it's the wrong spirit, that the formula for the alcoholic in Latin is spiritus contra spiritum, which means spirit against spirit. You see, we drink spirit, but it's the wrong spirit. And we come in here and we replace that other spirit with the spiritual life. What a great thing we've been given. And when I got out of there, I decided I'd go back to, my family went back to Scotland, and I decided I would go back to Jamaica. And unbeknownst to me, my eldest son had written to his father and said, Daddy, he was only 11 years old, and he said, Daddy, when I come back to Jamaica, I don't want to be with Mommy anymore because she's a drunk, because she's going to kill my little brother and I driving drunk. And he told his father everything. And for a little 11-year-old boy to do that, what a horrible thing. But thank God he had the sense to do it. And I went back to Jamaica. The father's children took them for a week, and after a week he said, you're not getting them back. My son's told me all about you, and if you try and take him, I'll put you on the stand. I'll put him on the stand in court. He said, and if you try and take them, I'll kill you. He said, he who holds the gold makes the rules. And I had my first suicide attempt. I was in that little rundown hotel house I had rented in Kingston. And I took two bottles of Valium and two bottles of 151 proof rum. Enough to kill a horse. But we don't die easy. Alcoholics are hard to dead. You know, when they say to me in Toronto, if I drink again, I'll be dead, I say, you wish. But what I remember is a moment of clarity. If that's what it was, I don't know. Sliding down that fridge, believing I was dying, and thinking, thanks, sweet oblivion, no more pain. Because I knew I could not live without my children. I knew I could not live without alcohol. I knew that I had come without knowing it, that there was no place else for me to go. And I was just tired of life, trying to fit in, trying to get someone to understand what's going on with me. And nobody did until I came to you. And then somebody phoned me and they took me up to hospital and pumped up my stomach. And the next day a psychiatrist came and told me something that was very observant, intellectually correct and definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, you mustn't do that anymore. And the children's father came and gave me the 2 years back money he had owed me when I was in Canada, the child support he owed me, and told me I had to get off the island. And my heart was broken. And it's never healed. My heart's cracked from losing my children. Just cracked. So I had to leave the island. And I went to Miami. I didn't know anybody and I didn't want to live. I love what Bob was saying. You know, I wanted to die, but I didn't want to hurt myself. You know? And I went to Miami to drink myself to death. I got a little apartment. I'd never been to Miami. I'd got an apartment, I'd drink and I'd pass out. People would come in and steal my furniture and steal my clothes and steal my jewelry and steal me because I'm a hopeless drunk. And I don't know anybody in Miami, and I leave my door open, and I'm a hopeless drunk. And eventually, my money was all gone, everything was gone, and I got thrown out of the apartment, and I ended up, I was in the U.S. illegally. You know, I didn't have any papers for U.S. And I ended up living at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. And my life down there was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. And then one day, it must have been a God thing. I said, God's always been chasing me. And an old woman, I used to live in Jamaica, an old English woman, now lived in Fort Lauderdale. And I saw her and I panhandled off her. I asked her for some money. And she contacted my family. And in the interim, my father had died. According to my mother, I found out later, my father had woke up at 3 o'clock one morning and said to my mother, I don't know where my lassie is, and I don't know where my grandchildren are, because nobody knew where I was. And he said, I'm going for a walk. and he dropped dead in the street of a massive heart attack at the same time I was living on the street. That's my legacy. And you know, I had two uncles that were in Japanese prisoner of war camps during the war, the Second World War. And I remember listening to them, and they told me that what their captors tried to do was to break their spirit. And they said that no matter what was done to them, they kept their spirit alive in hope. And I realized that glass in hand of a little innocuous fluid called ethanol alcohol, I had destroyed my spirit and drunk myself into a state of utter and complete hopelessness and despair. And when my family found me, they cried. And anyway, I went back to Canada. And man I had known for many years felt sorry for me and married me. He married me, I don't remember. And John is the one that saved my life. Because when I tried to kill him a couple of times, and he got afraid, like all my husbands, and he put me in the mental institution, and I'm 4 years in and out in the mental institutions, and I'm a retread in the mental institutions, and I love being in the mental institutions because I'm safe, you know. I love it. I love being in there. I get oblivion compliments of the government, and. And I get all my yum yums, my lithium, my librium, my valium, my yum yums. And the last time I was in there, I was taken by the police and I was in a lot of trouble. And because I was a registered psychiatric patient, they allowed me to go into psychiatric care to get me stable. And then I had to go to court. And my psychiatrist, who'd been looking after me for 4 years, he said, "Mari, I've had to write something to keep you out of prison." And he let me read it. And he said, "It's our opinion that this woman has three diagnoses: chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. She also seems to suffer from an abnormal need to be approved of and influenced by what other people say." That just about describes us, doesn't it? And the judge called me a tragic social circumstance. And I was a tragic social circumstance till I came to you. And one night I was drinking myself sober. They used to bring AA meetings into the institution, but I never heard anything because I was full of drugs. But something happened one night. I was drinking myself sober. You know that place? And I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan came, who had 28 years sobriety. He was a Métis, a French Indian. 28, him and I had nothing in common. And he 12-stepped me. And he told me his story. And for the first time, and I was 40 years old, and I'd never heard anybody talk about the things he spoke about to me. The feelings of difference, the feelings of being less than, the feelings of not being equal, not being quite enough. I thought, my God, we're so different. And he's talking about the things that went on in my soul all these years. And I said, "Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts." He said, "Mari, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches to fit any nut that comes through the door." And he made me laugh. And I had one slip. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. On the 9th of August, 1984, some AA people came and took me to a meeting. And I was in very bad shape. They told me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. Right, Joe? And that night, a little gal did what Bob described so much in his talk yesterday afternoon. She performed a service with me. That night, a little girl of 12 years sobriety spent the night with me. And the next day she said to me, after talking to me a lot about her journey, she said, anyway, I'm going to leave you now, because my sponsor said you're a loser. And I only stick with winners and Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. And I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And I knelt down and I held her hand. And what I thought about going through my mind, like a movie playing, was the previous November I got out of the mental institution. And I wanted to see my kids in Jamaica, and my family in Scotland arranged with a father in Jamaica that I could have them for Christmas. And he'd told me that I could come down there and he'd bring somebody to the airport, bring my boys, and that I could have them for a week in a hotel, and he'd come throughout the day to make sure I wasn't drinking. And I remember my sons were on the phone. They said, Mommy, Mommy, we heard you had another breakdown. They used to call it a nervous breakdown. And you've been in hospital again, and we miss you, Mommy. And we can't wait to see you. And the little one who was 11 and who'd written the letter said, Mommy, I didn't mean to write that letter. I said, don't worry about it. I'm coming to see you. I'm not drinking. I was on a lot of medication, though. They were treating me as a manic depressive on lithium. I had all other kind of medication. And I got on the plane, and I had the Christmas presents. I had to change planes in Toronto, and I bought a bottle of vodka. And between Toronto and Kingston, Jamaica, I drank that bottle of vodka. And when I got off the plane and saw my little son standing at the barrier shouting, Mommy, Mommy, and I dropped down drunk at their feet. And the person who brought them to the airport said, you won't be seeing your mother this trip. And led them away. And I remember lying on the ground, looking at my boys, looking over their shoulder at me, with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic. The broken promises and broken dreams one more time. And that's what I thought about. And it was enough despair to crack me open. And I knelt down and I held her hands and I said, God, I offer myself to thee. Repeating something I didn't even know to a God I didn't even know existed. And I've got goosebumps because I will tell you this. From that moment, I've never wanted another drink. William James, in a variety of religious experience, when he was going around finding out what had happened to all these people, because he was a pragmatist and he didn't believe this stuff. And he wanted facts. And he was going around with these people who had supposedly religious, spiritual experiences. And there was an old bunch of drunks that used to live on the street. And now they were running Water Street Mission. Reformed drunks. And they were helping other people. And they were praying to God. And he went to them and said, what happened to you guys? One minute your wino is living on the street, hopeless. And next minute you're becoming upstanding members of the community. And he said, the cumulative effect of everything they said, the common denominator, was that they had all suffered absolute and complete despair and hopelessness. And I believe that day I suffered that. I'd suffered despair before, but there was a new level to it that day. 10th of August 1984, and it cracked me open just for a little aperture for God's grace to come in. And I got very active in AA and got a sponsor. 6 weeks sober, I did a fifth step because I couldn't stand myself. I don't understand people who can wait a long time. I hated myself. I couldn't live sober, not with my head. You know, I just couldn't live sober. And it wasn't the best ever. It was, you know how I did it? I did it where it said, we'll never get better till we tell somebody all of our life story. And that's what I did the first time. I told all of my life story. And I did it with a Jesuit priest. I figured I'm going to give this back where I think it belongs, you know. He was a recovered alcoholic and he'd heard Fifth Step. And he was so gracious to me because I really wanted to shock him. There was part of me that was still a bad, feral person. But he, nothing sure, you know, and he was very loving to me and he spent so much time with me. And I came out of there and it was like, really, it was like this. For years I had been walking on the dark side of the street. I used to walk in the shadows. And now I come out of there and I want to walk in the sunshine. I want to cross over and get into the sunshine. You know, the men in AA were wonderful to me. They never bothered me. I don't know, 15 years ago I was in the Rockies, Calgary Rockies. I was doing a big book retreat. And they brought my first sponsor, Carol. She wasn't well, but her and I were sitting reminiscing. And I said to Carol, a lot of my sponsees are being 13-stepped. I was never 13-stepped. She says, do you remember what you looked like when you came in? She said, we used to take you to meetings in a shopping cart. You're jake leg. You don't hear a lot about that anymore, do you? But the men were wonderful to me and used to say, hold your head up, Mary, hold your head up. Because I used to walk around with my head down. I was so full of shame. And I'm so grateful for that. And they used to say to me, Mary, you can't speak for a year because you have nothing to say. That's what they told me. And I remember sitting around a discussion one day and I had something really important on this particular thing that I knew they had to hear. And I remember I said, there was a lull, so I decided to jump in, because you know, they're great talkers in AA, right? We love to talk. And I just said, jump in, and I said, excuse me, but I think, an elder, and he said, shut up. Who told you to think? Look what thinking got you. Take the cotton batten out of your ears and stuff it in your mouth. Listen. And it was Ernie that told me, do you want to know how you get well, Mary? You'll resign from the debating society. You'll learn how to take instructions. You'll admit to yourself that you know nothing. And that of yourself, you are nothing. Right? And I did it because I wanted to get well. I had a great desire to get well. And you know, I've told this story a lot, I know I have, but if for some reason, every now and then it comes into my consciousness. I didn't know what had got me sober, I didn't understand God. If I could understand God, God wouldn't be greater than me. But something was keeping me sober and I was praying to it. 32 years, every morning and night, I kneel down, I ask God to keep me sober and keep me sane this day. And I say other prayers as well and other things, but at night I kneel down and I thank God for keeping me. I will never take this deal for granted. I have heard some people say, I get up every day and I choose not to drink. I say, well, what are you doing here? If you could choose not to drink, what are you doing here? It's God keeps me sober. That's what I believe. Because of myself, I am nothing. And but before, you know, they said, Mary, you've got to find a God. You can't have Bill Wilson. He's dead. And I said, well, somebody's keeping me sober. So I went around looking for God. And there was an old woman, and she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. And she was saying things like, as a drunken woman, I never went to bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few. She said, but I don't do it anymore because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, Helen, who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God. She said, Mary, my God's called Harold. I said, Harold? That didn't sound too magnificent. Harold. She said, yep. You know that prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, Harold be thy name. She was pulling my leg. And then I'll just speed it up. Then eventually, 11 months, I heard my son was going to be going to school in Toronto. And my sponsor called Intergroup. And some AA people in Toronto met my plane. checked me into the YWCA downtown Toronto until I could get settled. It was a safe place to be. And I got an apartment, I got a job. Used to go to 3 meetings a day before I started work downtown Toronto. I got a sponsor called Renee D. She died with 53 years sobriety, sober every day. Renee taught me how to be a lady again, the lady my mother always wanted me to be, in Alcoholics Anonymous. Renee taught me many things, and I just loved her. And then I had my son came and went to school, and I had him for a year, making amends to my son. I'd fly up and down to Jamaica, make amends to my young son. My mom and dad were both dead by the time I got to AA, but, you know, I did a few things, and I also wrote them letters. And in those letters, I wrote everything I ever wanted to be. And I wrote to Mrs. Anne Gallagher, Kid of the Angels, Glasgow, Scotland. And I put a stamp on it and an airmail sticker. And my father, Mr. Richard Gallagher, Care of the Angels, Glasgow, Scotland. And posted it, and I can imagine a postman in Glasgow saying, another crazy alky making amends, you know. And then later on, my sponsor told me I should help old people across the road whether they wanted to go or not. Get over, I'm making amends. I don't want to go over. Get over. And my son went back to school, and I got very active in AA, and I just became a red-hot AA-er. I got married in AA. It didn't work out, because I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm no good at living together with anybody. I came to realize that. But John and I loved each other, and many years later, I found him on the ground. He had a massive stroke. I just happened to have a key for his apartment, and I had him home, and I looked after him for 5 years. And that was another way of making amends. And it was the most spiritual form of loving I've ever known. And then eventually my sons got thrown out of the father's house. My sponsor, Renee, told me to go down to Jamaica and be with my sons and make amends to the island. And I did that. And I went back to Jamaica and stayed with my old ex-mother-in-law. You really want to know how you're doing? Ask your old ex-mother-in-law. And, her and I got on very well, and my two sons, I got them off to school, one in Miami, one went to Scotland, and I stayed in Jamaica and worked for a while with the poor people down there, and then I came back. I tried to get AA going in Jamaica a little bit better than it was, and came back, and you know, I've done everything I'm meant to do. I've done everything I've been told to do. I've had wonderful sponsors. I'm very grateful to have a life of meaning and purpose. It's been, you know, I'm one of those that have had to, it's taken a long time for the personality change to come about with me, because, and I've had to work continually on it, you know, piece by piece by piece, and every now and then something pops up and I think that I've lost that, and one more time I realize it's still in there, and I'll give you a little example. About 4 years ago, I had to go back to work, because I'd looked after my husband for a lot of years. He was just childlike. He couldn't speak. He couldn't understand a spoken word. He had paralysis. So he needed me. He needed me 24/7. So I hadn't worked for a few years. And when he died, I realized, you know, I needed some money for a little pension. And I got a job. And God had put this woman in my life to test my serenity level. You know, this woman I was working for. And it was just her and I in this office, and she used to throw files at me. And, you know, and I could imagine picking up the file and wrapping it around her face, you know. But instead, you know, you can think what you like, but you got to act right. So I just say, you know, you shouldn't do that. You're going to make yourself angry. And then I'd go home and I'd get crazy. And anyway, after about 3 years of this, I go in one morning, and something, maybe that wasn't a good day. You know, every day I wake up, I'm not always in fit spiritual condition. Most days I am, but some days I have one of those gray chiffon days when I know I'm just not right. It's my alcoholism is acting in some way, and I don't know what it is, because I've done what I'm supposed to do, but I'm just not right. It must have been one of those mornings. And I walk into the office, and she's there, and as I walk through the door, she throws a file at me.
And I said, God, I'll see you when I come out. And I prayed. And I closed the door. And I took her inventory from when she was born. It's only 4 years ago, and I had that rage. You know that terrible rage? My sons used to call it napalm. And then it's gone. But how scary it is. And she's sitting cowering in her chair, this bully. And she said to me when I was finished, because I was shocked when I came out of this thing. I was shocked. And I'm just standing staring at her. And she said, I think you should go home. You're not feeling well. I said to her, you go home. I've got work to do. Because I didn't trust myself to walk out that office. And she left. And I got down on my knees and I wept. I was so ashamed of myself. I'm 28 years sober. What is this? I thought that rage and anger was gone. And I prayed to God to forgive me. And then I called my sponsor. And I told her and she said, I told you, you're always staying in relationships past the expiry date. She said, I want you to go in the morning and make amends and give a week's notice. And I did. And afterwards, I did a fourth step on that rage. You know, a 10th step is great. But when something like that comes up, that you thought you had got rid of long ago, you know, I had to do a fourth step on it. You know, and then a fifth step with Norma. And what we found out was that there was something, that woman just seemed to trigger something that was way back in my long, long ago life. It was like a hook, either real or imagined. And that was the way I had reacted. So you see, no matter how spiritual we get, we never rise above human being, right? But I'm sure a lot, but I'm not the woman I want to be, but I'm not the woman I used to be. My two sons got married and my eldest son asked me to walk him down the aisle with his daddy. And his daddy came up from Jamaica and him and I walked my son down the aisle. And my ex-husband is saying to me, my God, AA has worked wonders. We thought a leopard couldn't change its spots. My sponsor had told me I had to behave well, because I'd made amends to him, but I didn't like him. And I was in my AA Madonna. Thank you. Bless you, my child. Your wife looks wonderful, and the girls, they just finishing school in Switzerland. How wonderful, they look amazing. And inside I'm thinking, 20 years ago I hired two gunmen to shoot you. You were almost toast, my friend. And then my youngest son got married in full Scottish dress and danced with me to a tune called Mama. And I now have 5 little grandchildren. And New Year's, my kids give me a treat. One of my sons lives in Aruba and the other one lives on Vancouver Island. They said to me, Mommy, you're going to be with us and all the grandkids to bring in 2017 in Aruba. And I was down there with all my grandkids together around me and my two sons and my granddaughters. And when the bells went off at New Year's Eve, my sons came up and held me and said, Mommy, the constant thing in our life has been your love for us, no matter where you were. And no matter how down we feel, we know where you came from, and that gives us hope. And we love you. We love you. That is an alcohol. Nothing in the world. I thank Bill and Bob for their dedication and their love for people like me. Hopeless drunks that were beyond human aid. Prior to 1935, chronic alcoholics like me were doomed to die. What Bill and Bob got is amazing. And all the old-timers, I want to thank all the old-timers that were there before me and that have kept this thing going. There's a lot of stuff going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people want to change Alcoholics Anonymous. There's got a lot of people want to take God out of the program. Right? I'm so happy when I heard the Our Father. How can you get sober without God? It says this book is about finding God. There is one who is all power. That one is God. May you find him now. I was talking at Bob's group on Monday night, and after one, the guy came up and said to me, I love you, Mary, but you were a pontificating pillar of the program. And I thought, that's all right. That's all. We recently had in Toronto a guy, he made his AA group an atheist group, took God out the steps. We delisted the group. He took us to human rights. Human rights took us to court. We lost. We have to relist him. And then he publishes his full picture in the newspaper with his full name. But AA now has to accept agnostics. We've always had the atheists and agnostics from the get-go. But nobody's ever created a problem. We always say our group, we're going to say, for those of you who will, we'll say the Our Father. Is there anything else? At least, you know what? I mean, I'm a fundamentalist when it comes to AA. Because, really, what has to change in Alcoholics Anonymous? Nothing. Can you think of anything that needs to change? I can't. I want this thing. In July, I took my two granddaughters, they're both 15, from Tucson. I promised them, when you're 15, I'm going to take you to the old country. And I took them to the old country. And they walked on the soil that my ancestors have been walking on forever. One of them catch up in a fight with me, and I think, I am so glad that it is going to be there for this girl, because she's heading there. I want to thank you so much for having me here. I want to thank you for your graciousness, for your love. I want to thank you, AA, for the life I have been given. Bill Wilson said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is a chronicle of our colossal human failure, turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. And thank you.